The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and it's my honor to be here to introduce tonight's author. Acclaimed Kenyan scholar and writer, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, is the author of the novels A Grain of Wheat, Weep Not, Child, and Petals of Blood, among several other works of nonfiction, memoirs, children's books, and essays. The distinguished professor of English and comparative literature and the director of the International Center for Writing and Translation at the University of California, Irvine. He has been awarded 12 honorary doctorates, was nominated for the Man Booker Prize, and is annually tipped to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. He has received wide acclaim from the likes of the New York Times Book Review, The Guardian, and former President Barack Obama. He is here tonight with The Perfect Nine, the epic of Kikuyu and Mumbi. Written as a verse narrative, it blends folklore, mythology, adventure, and allegory into the origin story of the Kikuyu people of Kenya. The New Yorker calls it a, quote, sinuous retelling spun as an epic poem rivaling the Iliad in body count and surpassing it in whimsy. I love that word. Tonight's author is in conversation with Ketu H. Kutrok, professor in the Department of Drama at the University of California, Irvine. She was the founding chair of the Department of Asian American Studies at UCI, and prior to that, taught at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Yale. She is also the author of the forthcoming book, J. Pather, Performance and Spatial Politics in South Africa. The screen is all yours.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Jason.
And Ketu, thank you. Good to see you again.
Yes, definitely. So thank you, Ngugi. I am really honored to serve as an interlocutor, really, for your comments and for your readings. So first of all, I want to thank you for all your work. In all your work, you speak truth to power, something that we all aspire to. And in your dramas, in your essays, memoir, and now in this verse epic, The Perfect Nine. So it's a beautifully written story. It's already very well received. Jason read one review. And it's also described as a triumph of the form of the epic. And so I think it's a major achievement for you. It's described as using simple language that lays bare deep truths. And it showcases also, I think, your special talent in illuminating, indeed, and engaging passionately with Kikuyu culture, traditions, and history. So this is the first epic that is written in the Kikuyu language, that is your mother tongue. And an epic usually has adventure, drama, laughter. It also teaches certain values, moral values of family, love, courage. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, about the epic form and what attracted you, you know, to create these characters, the encounters, and telling us the origin story of Kikuyu and Mumbi. So what is it about the epic that attracted you to this form?
You know, first of all, let me say, in the introduction, by the way, Jason said I was a director of the International Center for Writing and Translation. I'm the founding director, but I'm no longer direct. It's being directed by somebody else right now. Yeah, and it's going strong. Yeah. Yes, the epic form. Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, first of all, let me say the story on which my epic is based is actually a story which has been told to virtually every Kikuyu child. Yeah? And it's the myth of the origins of the Kikuyu people. Everybody in the world, most communities in the world, most peoples have a myth of origin. Of course, one of best known all over is one of the Jewish myths of origins, you know, about Adam and Eve. Yeah. The Koyo people have their own version, well, not a version, the origin, they have original man and woman, who is the Koyo, the man, and Mombi, the woman. And they say that the legend, as we were told as children, is that they had only 9 daughters, or actually 10, but they always said 9, or full 9, hence the idea of the perfect 9 becomes actually literally 10. And they had no brothers, or presumably no eligible men around. But anyway, God went back to the mountain, Mount Kenya, the mountain of the moon, and he talked with God, and the following morning there were 9 handsome young men. So after that follows the myth of origins, you know. I'll tell later my additions, you know, by my interpretation, but that the basic story is there. So when you write when you base your interpretation on a myth which is well known, there are things you cannot change.
Yes.
There must be a Koyo in our case, and the woman Mombi, and you must, their names are the same name. You can't give them different names, okay? And there were 9 daughters who are the founding matrix of the 10 Gikoyo clans. And again, you cannot change that, no matter how you interpret it, okay? Yeah. But how did I come to it? Two things. I must say, I was actually, first, in terms of the drama of what's happening, it was actually, I was somewhere along the Pacific Ocean, and Sketu and I know we live very near. We live on University Hills of the University of California, which is literally about 5 to 10 miles to get to the Pacific Ocean. And one time I was being by the ocean side, and sort of the vastness or the Pacific Ocean. I don't know why, out of the blue, it brought back the Koyo myth of origins, yeah.
Right.
But around that, I had actually been reading quite a lot of epics. You know, I've been involved in epics. You know, I'm a student of English, so I have read, of course, you know, Odyssey and the Iliad of Homer. But recently, I've also become very preoccupied with the Indian epics, Mahabharata, or Mahabharata specifically. There was Mahabharata, of course, and Ramayana are some of the two greatest, you know, sort of epics in the world, but they are of Sanskrit origins in terms of language in which they were composed. And even more recently, I was reading another one from Catalonia in Spain. Yeah. They have, it's called Canigo, I think. Yeah. Mm. Based on the Mount Canigo, which looks, Canigo has a lot of snow on top. When I looked at that, I remembered also Mount Kenya has permanent snow on top. That's why it's called the Mountain of the Moon. So I think all those factors, the vastness of the Pacific Ocean, and the fact I've been reading all those epics and so on, you know, think all those things came together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this, I think of it as your only creative work that has nothing to do with colonialism, because colonialism didn't exist at the time. Mm. So it's really a true kind of pre-colonial reality of the origin story that you are recreating. And that's also a beautiful contribution, you know, from, in terms of your whole repertoire of all the works that you have done.
The only contemporary, I don't know how to put this one, is my own thinking. When I started thinking about the myth, when I was watching the Pacific Ocean, there are two things that I remembered, you know, that the women had no brothers, And it's never really been an issue before. Mm? Mm. So it occurred to me that these women must have been doing everything themselves. They had no brothers to rely upon or to say, this is a man's work, eh? This is a woman's work. No. They had to know how to build houses. They had to know how to hunt or to cultivate. They had to know how to make things. So I was struck by, wait a minute, in this very myth of origins, we have women as a union, creative union of the mind, hands, you know, and body, so to speak. Mm. Right, and that's, you know, and then I said to myself, like, whisper, oh my God, this must be the original feminists, yeah? So a combination of those, all those things may have triggered the...
Yeah, I was gonna ask you about that phrase, you know, the original feminists, in terms of how self-reliant these women are. They have complete agency over their lives, over the men that they choose to live with, and all of the skills that they have, you know. It's like you wouldn't normally think that these are women's skills, about building houses or creating their own clothes. I wanted to ask you, connected to that, you know, and then they also, the nine women also create the nine Gikuyu clans.
Yes, so they are the matriarchs,
role. But in terms of that, I wanted to ask you to comment on the centrality of women, of females, you know, in Gikuyu society, and the roles that they have to play, maybe even in contemporary times.
First of all, let me say, Gikuyu women, like, may I say, all women in the world, or say women in the world, they do one thing that no man I know has been able to do, that is carry each one of us, whether we are man or female, for a good 9 months. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that in itself already makes woman the central vehicle of life, really. And you know, because no male I know of, even the bravest or the strongest or the he had a woman carry him for 9 months. And that's very important. Actually, it comes across in the epic, by the way, this recognition of the centrality of woman in that respect. But also historically, in our society that I know of, you know, women have played a very important role. They may not always be remembered in history books, but in real history, like in our struggle against the British colonial settler regime, they were everywhere in the rural areas, the mountains fighting. Some of them were jailed, you know, in concentration camps and so on, you know. So we have very, even individual women, we have very strong women in our history. They are not always recognized as such. Mm. And that's why I think the perfect nine is also important in it's that recognition, you know. But my mother, for instance, let me just put it this way. My mother played, apart from carrying me for 9 months, but she also played a very central role in my own education. Mm. You know, although dare I say she could not read or write, but she sent me to school. Mm. And followed that with very penetrating questions, you know, and encouragements, you know, and always asking me whether what I had done was actually the best that I could have done. So she implanted the idea of the best in me. So I am, because my mother was,
And even in the play that you and Mishere Mugo wrote together, The Trial of Didan Kimathi, we had the strong character of the woman and, you know, the links that the women provided to the fighters in the mountains And the ways in which they continued the struggle was very
important. It's actually, that's really a reflex of what happened historically, you know, in Kenya. And in that sense, I'm glad if the perfect nine reflects that centrality of women in our society and in our lives.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the major contributions, you know, of the epic itself. And you think about worldwide, you know, many of the women who have played important roles are invisible, you know, in the history books, as you said.
Yes.
So it's always an effort to excavate, you know, to bring these stories back to light and for people to kind of learn to recognize the roles that they have played.
I said that's very important. I appreciate the fact that many of the commentaries on the epic have so far, nearly all of them have pointed out the centrality of these women in the narrative.
So just going back to the epic, you know, I mean, I think Jason also pointed out from the New Yorker, I also regard your work in this verse epic, you know, as kind of in line with the major epics of the world. So you already mentioned the Mahabharata and how that has fascinated you. We've had some conversations about that.
Right.
The Iliad and the Odyssey and other cultures like Icelandic epics or even the Persian epics, you know.
Oh, I should have mentioned how much there was a period, actually, at my first year at UCI, actually, for some reason, I discovered Icelandic or rediscovered Icelandic, you know, epics, you know, and I used to really read them over and over again because there they have some, oh my God, incredible.
Right.
They have incredible women characters, by the way.
And I think working with the International Center for Writing and Translation when you were the director, I think we had some Icelandic poets also invited to UC Irvine.
That was my Icelandic period, so to speak.
And then I just wanted to mention that from the Caribbean, you know, from St. Lucia, Derek Walcott, you know, he did his own adaptation of Homer in his long verse poem called Omeros. And that came out in 1990, and then he won the Nobel Prize in 1992. So
what are you suggesting, Professor?
very open suggestion to everyone who's listening, you know, that you have been in the running for the Nobel Prize for a long time. Epic, it might happen.
Maybe epic might be the route to that.
But I think that maybe you want to also share your amazingly philosophical interpretation when you describe the Nobel of the heart.
Yeah.
You know, I love how you describe. Maybe you want to tell the audience about.
No, what I think is this Nobel Prize is obviously important, you know, and it's good to remember. I mean, all those who have had it have earned it, you know, and it's as important. Wole Soyinka was the first Black African to get that, you know, that honor. And there are others, you know, from Africa, three of them from Africa who have had that, you know, prize and all over the world. And that's very good. I mean, you know, I congratulate them, you know, all. But then I remember there are also other writers whom I like very much who never got the Nobel Prize. You know, Tolstoy, for instance, you know, one of the biggest, I mean, sort of greatest novelists or writers in the history of literature. He didn't get it, you know. On the other hand, some other people whose I have no idea why they got it, like Churchill. I mean, he was a historian more than he was a literary person, you know. This is not to devalue the honor, it's very important, you know. But I also say there's another thing which is also equal, for me equally important. And that is, like once I visited India for the first time, And I've met a person there who is quite active politically, who said that, who told me, he didn't have to tell me this, but he told me that he was actually thinking of committing suicide. Oh. And he happened to enter a bookshop, you know, where our friend is, and he started fingering my book, Devil on the Cross, the one I wrote in prison. And this apparently struck him so much. I mean, I don't know how it struck him, but it gave him, he told me himself, it gave him a new leash of life, you know. And his interest in activism on behalf of the masses began with reading that particular book. So I call that kind of reaction the Nobel of the heart, because it comes from the heart. When you meet somebody and they tell you, I was thinking about this, then I read your book and this happened to me, that's really very, very special. But I also like the Nobel of the Heart for another reason. It's very democratic, because it's available to every writer. And every writer knows, has encountered that Nobel of the Heart at one time or another, right? Yeah.
Right.
So it's very attractive in every possible way, But it's not to demean the other one. It's also equally important, you know, and
Sure.
And if the epic is a way of getting it, then be it so.
Maybe that's a lucky charm. Who knows?
Yeah, right. Yeah, thank you.
But I also love the idea of the democratic nature of, you know, any writer who gets that kind of appreciation.
Yeah, people get that reaction. That's a Nobel. They are conferring him or her the Nobel of the Heart. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I have a question, another question about the epic. And then after that, perhaps you might like to read from it. So this is a question also connected to the democratic impulse that you just talked about. And that is to do with the spirituality in the epic, which, you know, the way I read it, it's different from like religion, where you have rules and regulations and rituals and so on. But the spirituality, you know, like the supreme giver, as you call him in the text, it's a very open-ended and very tolerant, creating unity among people of different kind of faiths. So I just wanted you to elaborate on this notion of spirituality.
I'll come to spirituality, but let me tell you a few things which I added to the original narrative. They're quite interesting. You know, in the original myth, the Gekoyo goes to the mountain. If the following day, he just gets exact number, 9 to 10. But I know also Gekoyo people, when something happens, they don't say, I did it. They say, God made it, made me do it, or God did it for me, right? Or if something happens, which is good, they say, thank God, it's God who has brought it about, okay? So I assumed now there was more to the 9 young men appearing than the statement that God brought them there, But how did he bring them? That's my addition, you know? And I imagined the beauty of these 9, 10 daughters spreading across the continent. And you see this beauty in their dreams, okay? And each one of them leaves their own home to in pursuit of the dream of perfect beauty. But then he finds on the way, when there are many others who are also on the same search. So only 99 managed to get to the mountain of the moon. But 99 are too many for the 10, right?
Right.
So they are given a task, and the task is this. One, to get the nature of the task, let me put it this way. One of the girls, 9, one who makes 10, actually is a grown woman like others, but she has very weak legs. Eh? So she crawls, okay? She doesn't walk upright, she walks. And there's one thing which can cure that, and that is a hair that grows in the middle of the tongue of an ogre, man-eating ogre. And this ogre is invisible. You cannot tell where it is, its size, or when it's going to strike. So they have to come back with this hair because it will help in probably healing the legs of the 10th daughter, okay? So that's, you know, so the 99 men and women, and then, and by the way, and the girl had to accompany them so that they can judge for themselves the character of whomever they fall in love with, okay? So that's my, was my own addition in of the 99 men and women, and the tasks they are given, mm-hmm. or the dangers they encounter, including this one of invisible foe. And let me tell you, people, this was written before the corona. Okay? Yeah. This invisible foe. And the secret of how, well, I won't tell you the secret of how they do it, but when they come to kind of, they have, how do they overcome a foe they cannot see? The one thing they have to walk together. Yeah. But I'll not say more than that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're asking what the
about the spirituality.
Spirituality. One of the things which is found by the in all mythologies, Mahabharata, Homer, Greek mythologies, I mean Icelandic, you know, Norse mythologies, you know, is consciousness of the unity of the human and nature. Okay. You find characters, how human characters interact with their environment. Sometimes they can even transform, like metamorphosis of metamorphosis.
Yeah.
You know, in metamorphosis, people actually do, you find a girl running, and then by the time before you catch her, she is turned into a tree, or some other gazelle or something, you know. And you find a similar thing in Mahabharata, where people, some people, there's a woman who is born out of a fish, and she becomes the mother of one of the most active participants in the epic, you know, Mahabharata, for reasons, you know. So that conscious nature is very important. And then in our own stories, Ogiko stories, real ones. I was told, well, okay, let me tell you, my mother, you went to the shamba or the fields, my mother, and you pulled one tree, you had to plant another one in that same spot or near that same spot, okay? So many stories, not just African, of pre-capitalist social formations all over the world, they are very conscious of the unity of the human nature. And by the way, Ketu, they are right. In this way, humans, nature, if you like, can do without the human, but the human cannot do without nature. We cannot do without the air we breathe, the water we drink, even the very earth on which that makes us start, be able to walk, okay, or to build houses, right? We depend on the earth for everything. So it's ridiculous for the capitalist mindset, which is the nature of the civilization we have now, where the human thinks he or she can do without nature, or, you know, and it's, no, it's not, you know, it's not true.
Right.
We are all equally dependent on nature. And when we ruin the air the waters or whatever, we're doing something which is, I don't know what, devilish, huh? Right? You know, whereas the other one is closer to the spiritual, right? The spiritual in life, the spiritual in the environment, the spiritual in the human, okay? The spiritual in that connection between us and how our lives are very dependent on the small insects that break the air and create oxygen in the soil. You know, or the bee that helps in cross-fertilization, right? You know, I mean, all those things. But capitalism tells us, as long as you chase profit, it does not matter how people, many people die in your chase of the increasing rate of profit. It does not matter how many trees you destroy, how much water you spoil, or air, or things like that. So the prophet is very conscious of that connection with nature, you know, and the original father and mother, they always tell their daughters about environment, you know, and about trees, about animals, you know, about water, about, you know, not to take them for granted.
That's a beautiful way to think about spirituality, like the animism in nature and every living creature that you know we have on earth along with the humans. As I said, nature can survive without people, but we cannot survive without nature. So that's a very powerful, you know, message for us to think about in terms of where we are now, you know, with the environment and how we are abusing all kinds of, you know, the earth, water, and many other natural sources.
Right. In the past, the mother Mumbi is always talking to her daughters about that, you know. They tell them how they survived the journey to the mountain and the moon. And so they are always stressing that mutuality of human and the natural environment.
Right. And I just want
and spirituality relies in that consciousness of mutual dependency between human and another human, like in the Bantu saying, I am because you are. But the same can be extended to nature. We are because nature is, right?
So I think that your epic brings that out really beautifully, you know? And it shows that sort of unification or how human beings can work with nature, you know, with kind of not enmity, but with harmony. And that is a mutually beneficial kind of reality.
That's to me very, very important. And as I said, you find that recognition in nearly all mythologies, actually.
The only thing is that I was going to just bring up that since you have really been fascinated with the Mahabharata, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, the religious doctrine that a lot of the Hindus follow, it's a philosophical and a kind of religious text. But in that text, you know, there is a huge hierarchy of human beings, and that's sort of rooted in the Hindu caste system. And there are a lot of moral dilemmas about how certain actions are taken up, where the ends of the actions are rather dubious, you know. So it does assert that unity that, you know, your epic does for me.
No, true, there's hierarchy, but the we cannot take whatever mythology tells us, literally, right? You know, I don't think for instance, the mother of, what's that family called? The very, in Mahabharata, Pandavas. You know, I don't think she was born literally from the fish, right? Any more than I think in the Bible, the biblical story of Jonah surviving in the belly of the fish.
Right.
And vomited out on the other side where he was sent by God, you know. I don't take it literally, you know. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, you see, the hierarchy we find in nature is really one of equal give and take.
Right.
Even if you see a tree which is very big, is very dependent on small, and there's something which that big tree is doing and giving back to the environment, you know. But of course, hierarchy is a human invention. By that, I mean human in the sense that it's not, when we say I am because you are, that's mutual. Yes. We're talking about mutuality, right?
Yes.
Is a relation of give and take, equal give and take. You know, I am because you are, right? Okay, yeah. But of course, alongside religions, of course, comes social systems that are some against the very spirituality which is implied, you know, in the in the mythology of that very, you know, society. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I would love for you to read something from the epic, and if you would like to share something, a song in Gikuyu for our audience. And then after that, I wanted to talk a little bit about language, but we don't want to run out of time. So I wondered if you would please read something.
Okay, yeah. You know, if you talk about language, then that's me. I can stay here for the next 5 hours.
I know, that's what I want you to read first.
No, I often, the epic, and by the way, the epic is, as I said, originally written in Gikuyu language as Keda Muyuru. And it came out in Kenya, I think, 1.5 years ago or something, anyway, before the corona, anyway. It was out. And it's been selling quite well. You know, the publisher are surprised, you know, that it could sell about 2,500 copies within the first 1.5 years. So, yeah. This goes against those who say, oh, a book written in an African language cannot sell, you know, but yeah. So this one, the English translation, The Perfect Nine, came out in October. I did my own translation though, yeah. And it begins by telling how the original man and woman, Gikuyu and Mobi, they just travel from some deja, not always defined, from some momentous event somewhere else. So they are searching for the perfect land, so to speak, you know. And that's why they learn many things, because they have to depend on each other. The Gikuyu has been on Mombi, and Mombi has been on him, anyway, yeah. And then nature around them, you know, that's how their own journey to the mountain is almost an educational journey at the mountain, okay? They pass many lands before they get to Mount Kenya. And when they get there, they just stop. Say, look, mountain of the moon. The landscape around it was beautiful. And for a moment, they were at a loss for words to describe the undulating plains that spread out before them, or the hills and valleys that hedged them in, or the river that flowed through the green lilies and reeds. Countless animals of different shapes and colors bend low over the waters, drinking and lowing and grunting and roaring in delight. others strutted about the banks or simply basked in the sun. Ikoyo and Mombi turned to each other and murmured something. They were captives to their wonder. And then they resumed gazing at the peaceful green land below. Then they stretched their arms in grateful reverence. We receive this with all our hearts, O Giver Supreme, they said in unison. Thank you, owner of the ostrich whiteness, for this land which you have given us, our children and our children's children. And they say, and then they get a bit of the moon white around them, and it's splattered in different directions, each time saying, you know, they turn to the north, to the east, to the west, and they say, peace, glory to thee, give us supreme peace. Then they turn to the east, the land of the rising sun, peace, glory to thee, give us supreme peace. And last, the west, the land of the setting sun, peace, glory to thee, give us supreme peace. And suddenly they felt their souls stir and soar with joy. They recalled other places they had journeyed through, you know, beautiful like this, but they had not been taken up in the same way. And now all the beauty they had left behind has reappeared tenfold for them to reap. More gratitude to the Giver Supreme welled up inside them, and they broke into hymn of praise. Mwene nyaga etwa kogada, nyoda koyo adera take, terioyo joe naide manyinge, ona nyamo kulemba minge. Twadi kereria, twayuga magambo, wakunga yo getwera ate, oda koyo mo menyerere, todo wode neriri wake. The last one was thankful. They had a voice, and when they had the voice of the Giver Supreme telling them that this land which he has shown them, they must take care of it, because everything in it reflects the glory of the Supreme, Giver Supreme. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was just beautiful also for the audience to hear you speak it in Kikuyu. So before we take the questions, perhaps we can talk just a little bit about language. And you wrote the epic first in Kikuyu. I know years ago you said that you would write all your fiction in Kikuyu, and then thankfully for the English readers, you would translate it yourself into English. And that happened in prison when you took that decision. You wrote the novel Devil on the Cross in Kikuyu, and then it was translated. And since then, Wizard of the Crow, a monumental novel that you wrote first in Kikuyu and then translated into English, and now the epic. So I know that language is a question very dear to your heart, you know, mother tongues. When I worked with you at the International Center for Languages, you were very passionate about how we work to promote mother tongues, how we promote translations. So maybe you could share a few ideas with the audience.
What I've been quite is look. You are quite right. The language thing struck me even more strongly, if you like, when in 19th December 31st, 1977, I was arrested by the Kenya government and put in a maximum security prison for having participated and being one of the authors of the play I'll Marry When I Want in Gikuyu Gahika Deda. And we wrote it original in Gikuyu, and was performed by literally the small farmers, peasants, and factory workers and plantation workers, you know, literally, you know. And it was very, very successful in terms of audiences and demand and so on. And the Kenya government just arrested me punitively and put me in a maximum security prison. So how did the idea of that language come into my being imprisoned? One, I started thinking, how come that if a Gikuyu speaking president, right, was among one who sent me to prison for writing in Gikuyu, right, an African language, right? Then I started thinking, my God, the role of language in colonial domination, right? Everywhere, there's a colonial thing, the languages of the colonized were literally either wiped out or subordinated to the colonial one. And some of these thoughts are the ones which years later would make the book Decolonizing the Mind. But I also said, now from now onwards, I will not be writing my fiction novels and printing in, or plays, especially plays in English. I'll be writing them in the language which was the basis of my incarceration, okay? So that's why I wrote that novel, you know, on toilet paper called, you know, Shaitan Mudarafaine, or translated as Devil on the Cross. And I've continued my poetry. Now the epic play have now been in Gikuyu language only. Essays, academic essays, and my memoirs have been in English, but otherwise the rest of my writing largely has been in Gikuyu. I've not retreated since. But I did come to think about languages in Ireland, what the Irish language was done, was how it was decimated or weakened, you know. I looked at Native American languages, how they were similarly, you know, subordinated to English, you know, how the Maori language in New Zealand, again, where people were actually beaten to bleed, to their bodies bleeding, when they were caught speaking Maori in the school compound, right? Same in Australia, it's everywhere. So it become, so now today, I'm totally opposed to languages relating to each other in terms of hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And I keep on saying, there is no language which is more of a language than any other. That every language has its own musicality, and there's one who can say its musicality is somehow more musical than the musicality of any other language, even if spoken by a few people. They can play the same melody, but their musicality, like musical instruments, you know, we have the piano, with guitar, with the violin, you know, and another instrument all over the world. And we don't say, I like the piano is a higher musicality, it must be, we must abolish all the other musical instruments and leave the piano alone or only, or the guitar, okay? Each language, even if spoken by, has its own musicality, unique to itself. But that music also carries memory, the knowledge system of the environment, and many other things at the same time, okay? Note that with musical instruments, when they come together, the guitar and the piano can come together and they create orchestra or quartet or whatever, right? And harmony, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't, musical instruments don't meet each other in terms of hierarchy. That maybe even though I play guitar and piano together, the guitar is not important, right? Right? Yeah. So languages are in the same way. Each language has its musicality unique to itself. English has French has, Russian, so has Yoruba, is Zulu, Ikoyo, Sanskrit, Hindi, Gujarati, I mean, Mandarin, Japanese, and all these languages. Why put them in hierarchical relation to each other? Why not let them meet on the basis of equal give and take? And that's where translation comes in, which I normally describe as the language of languages, because I say it's a language, it's a common language of all languages, because any one language can be translated into another. The main of it is to capture the musicality of the original. That's not possible, that's unique to that language, right? But they may try to capture the spirit of the other one in the musicality of, say, English or Gujarati, you know, or Hindi, you know, so on, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And this is such an important question that faces really the world, you know, because issues of small publishers, you know, trying to get ahead, publishing in languages that may not have a big market. And yet, you know, you need to have governments that can foster that so that even you also talked about intra-regional translations, you know, like Africa, the whole continent. If Kiswahili or Gikuyu translated into Yoruba or into Zulu, you know, those kinds of connections would be so unique for human beings.
Yeah, I think there's a world in front of all of us when more there's mutual translation from one language into another and so on, you know. Another saying which I have to say here is what I say, that monolingualism is a carbon monoxide of cultures. And multilingualism is the oxygen of cultures. And you can see, no matter which language, the tendency for languages, literally, it's to split into many. You know, even English language and its regional variations, the tendency is to split into many. But authority try to don't split into many, let's be uniform. Instead of allowing the two things to be there spontaneously, where language can both grow, connect to the languages, but also can be a structure which allows communication across the different languages and so on,
Yeah, so, I mean, you have rightly been called a language warrior, and this is definitely important, a very important issue to you and really for our audience, you know, to think about some more.
Because I came to realize, you know, initially when I was writing Decolonizing the Mind, I used to think it was a European colonial, an African, okay? I didn't realize it was, I was just thinking about it. I thought, my God, this is what was done to India. This was done to Native American. This was done to Irish, for instance, you know, was done to all over. Whenever one people have conquered another, the first thing they do is to suppress the language of the conquered and impose the language of the conqueror on them, okay? So that the language of the conqueror becomes a measure of intelligence and even spirituality. You can't speak to God until you speak English, you know. And in heaven, people will be speaking English or French, right? So the assumption being, oh, even God, actually, even God speaks English. So somehow or other, even Adam and Eve were speaking English or French. It's not true, you know, it's not true.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the colonial domination. You're right, languages are the first things that are attacked and suppressed, and then the colonizer's language gains a lot of power.
Yeah, a lot of power. Which I always keep on saying that when you change to things, I've come, by writing in Gikuyu, in some ways I've come to appreciate writers like Shakespeare and Dickens, Moore or Tolstoy, because the challenge which I meet in writing my own language, I find they had met similar languages in their own language and see what they, I come to now to value more, what they produced. But yeah, some of those writers like Rabelais in the case of French, some of those writers like Shakespeare, I find them, or in Spanish, the one who wrote the Don Quixote, for instance. Now I find them amazing, and I really enjoy them in a different way from when I was reading them from the point of view of these masters, these English as this. But when I come to see English met similar challenges like any other language, and I can see what some of the writers did with that language, then for me it becomes inspiring for me to do similar thing in Gikuyu. Right.
That's amazing. So I think in the time we have left, maybe I should just take a look at the questions that have been posed. Okay. I have to apologize for the notifications that come in through my email and they're making a sound. I'm so sorry. I don't know how to switch that off. Okay. There's a question here about other African epics that may have influenced your own. That's one question. And another question is, are you suggesting that the idea of mutuality and codependence between humans and nature is intrinsic to the epic form?
I'm not sure, but it has happened that in the epic form, because they come from community, I guess because many epics are pre-capitalist. They are capitalism is the one which author hierarchy, profit, the rising rate of profit becomes the thing people choose, property, accumulation of property, whether you've got 10 houses and you must think you're not satisfied unless they are 12, and you get 12, you're not satisfied until they are 14, you got one car, that's why you need three or four, and a boat, and an aeroplane, and a part. Now, pre-capitalist societies as a whole, pre-capitalist societies were dependent on each other anyway. Mutual dependence was very important. Neighborliness was something real, right? Now, in the suburbs of today, neighborliness has almost no meaning, literally. You are next to each other, but you don't know each other.
Right.
Remember, in most pre-capitalist social formations, people, even if they don't see you for a couple of days, pass by your door and ask, hi, how are you? I was just checking in on you. Sit down, have a cup of tea. And then, if they get too much harvest, they shared it with people around them. It was second nature to, but capitalism, the more you have, even though you can, I get fun in thinking, you can note, you can only, at least the Wizard of the Crow, where someone is wondering, he's wondering about the accumulation because he wonders, but you can, no, I think it's in one of my novels anyway, where they talk about, he gets so wealthy and yet he finds 1 meal satisfies him like any other person, okay? And he can only wear one pair of clothes at any one time. And it is more, he could wear 20 trousers at the same time, but he cannot, right? Yeah. So that one is more of a capitalist thing. Capitalism is driven by profit. And does not matter even if you kill your father or your mother or your whatever it is. It does not matter if you tell people, don't worry about COVID. You know, just go out, you know, don't wear masks, you know. It's taking away your time from the factory, right?
Yeah.
That a thinking which is not consonant with epics, I don't think. You look at all epics, that mutual dependence, that mutual care, that mutual understanding that we depend on each other and on the environment is very much governs a lot of behavior in our society. Yeah.
That's right. And talking about corporations and, you know, capitalism, I just wanted to let the audience know about your volume of essays called Global Ethics, The Politics of Knowing, which also includes some of the issues about language, also includes issues about globalization and, you know, the kind of world that we live in now in terms of literature and culture. So it's a wonderful collection of essays that you might want to look up also by Googie. Yeah. So the one question was about if there were any African epics influenced your thinking about epics.
Sudieta, I think for instance, Sudieta, you know, I read this a long time ago, but it must have influenced me a little bit in the conception of the character, one of the characters, Waringa. Warigia in the epic, the one, the girl who is the body of a grown-up, but that of a child, you know. I think Sudieta, one of them, was similarly born with a defect. And how they the part of the epic is also how they overcome the challenge, if you like. I don't know, maybe not call it defect, but maybe not this challenge, and they become these heroic figures,
Right. Yeah, let me see if we covered any other questions from the audience. I think we've covered most of them. I didn't quite understand this question. What did revision look like for this epic?
Oh, translation.
Well, it says revision. So I think you talked about how you added things to the original story.
I like to call it interpretation, but what's interesting about myths, or there are things you have to work within a framework of, you know, that many of the features of that epic as told. And as I said, for instance, I cannot add to the daughters of Mombi, right? People say, no, it's not true. Right? I cannot alter the fact that there was Gikuyu and Mombi, right? They would say, no. People not accept it, you know. Yeah. But whatever you do, you stay. You can alter the story of Jesus Christ, but you can't alter the one fact which every Christian believes in. That he was crucified on a cross. If you leave that out, then we say, "Oh no, you're not talking about."
right. Yeah.
So there are some things. Yeah, there are some things you have to keep, but you can interpret them differently. That's a key. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The person who asked the question says, "How did the work change over time as it was written?" So you know the story, but then in your own interpretation, you added a few things within the framework.
Yeah. And she is asking what? Sorry.
Yeah, I think that you answered the question. Yeah. The question was, how did the revision work and how did the work change over time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's in that sense, by the way, even when stories or these mythologies are told, many versions begin to emerge. You know, for instance, take the case of the Greek drama, for instance, all those playwrights used to work on the same myths, but they produced very different plays, you know. Sometimes the characters would have the same names, but really they do incredibly different things, you know, yeah. Right. Even Mahabharata, I think, has different versions.
And it's written over centuries too. You know, it's to pin down a time. for some of the epics. So that also makes some change a little bit.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of it used to be orally transmitted. Yes. So as you told the story, you also, there's a way in which you'd emphasize certain things rather than others and so on. Yeah.
That's another thing I thought would attract you to the epic form as an oral kind of storytelling tradition. So you've written about orality and how important that is, you know, within African cultures.
I think with all cultures, because the orality, you remember, or the oral was prior to the written. The written tries to, writing science try to imitate the spoken, right?
Yes.
You know, the, we make signs, but those signs are supposed to create the oral, I mean,
The sound.
Right.
So I think we don't have any other questions. I had one question to ask you about the number nine, you know, since you called it the perfect nine. Whether the number nine has any kind of special meaning within Gikuyu culture, because within the Indian culture, nine is a very powerful mystical number. Even multiples of nine, like 18, is very important. There are 18 chapters in the Mahabharata. There are 18 chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. And there are many other things that connect to nine, like nine primary emotions, nine major planets, and so on, you know. So I was just curious whether nine had any particular significance.
I don't think so. I can't think of, apart from the fact that we have nine clans or 10 clans, because we've got nine or full nine, which is 10. Right, you know, but I don't think as a number, I may be wrong, but I don't think it is. When I was growing up, I didn't think it had a particular significance apart from its significance as the nine clans or the nine daughters of Ekoe and Mombi. Yeah.
Right.
But when I was writing, though, the epic, I'm not a poet. Let me.
You are a poet.
let me first of all say that. So the epic is my first attempt at verse, really. And the way I thought, I didn't want to worry much about rhymes that come from the end, the words at the end rhyming, but I use the word, the number nine and 10 interchangeably, and multiples of those, you know, or like, for instance, I'd have sometimes some lines are 9, 9 or 10, 10 or 5, 5 or 3, 3, right? I mean, I played around this. And some lines I tried to, in equal, I tried to the length would be about 10 syllables. Imagine, I use the structure of the nine daughters and 10 also to help me structure the epic. It did not always work, but when it worked, it was actually quite interesting.
Quite exciting. Because you do use the threes, you know, the Trinity, the past, present, future, and 3, 3, and 3 is 9 also.
There's where I talk about the Trinity, the three. When I look at everything and I see there's a threesome in most things. And I was struck. This, it's not something I haven't thought about, but when I was talk about Trinity, it made me remember the Egyptians had organized their entire system in terms of threes. Their gods were always three, you know, largely God the mother, God the father, and often an only child. And I suspect Christianity may have borrowed from the Egyptians because the idea of Trinity was ingrained in Egyptian religious system and outlook. And the idea of an only son was always, nearly always there. And the idea of resurrection, the idea of resurrection really was part of Egyptian belief system anyway. Yes. And some, yeah, and they built these tombs, you know, to ensure successful resurrection of the occupants, that kind of thing. Yeah. So ideas of resurrection, the idea of father, mother, son, only son, you know, that idea of Trinity was very much there. But then I found out there's Trinity in most things we do. Hmm? Mm-hmm. The Trinity of day, you know, morning, noon, you know, evening, or evening, midnight, so, you know.
Right.
Yeah, three, yeah, Trinity.
Right. Well, thank you so much. I think that Jason said we could sort of end after an hour or whenever we like. It's an hour and 15 minutes, so I don't think there are any other
maybe questions. When if you, okay, I'll challenge, maybe when you have read the Perfect Nine, we can always come back.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, whenever we can always come back, and then you'll have, you know, thoughts that have come through after reading, right? Yeah, so it's a challenge. Yeah, for people to go and read, then we gather again, okay, and talk that's about it. Great. Yeah, yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
Okay, Jason has put the link in the chat so people can order the book from the bookstore that he's put down.
Right.
And I guess we can thank Jason, Andy, and just...
And to remind people, the idea of the invisible four, that came before the corona.
Yes, yes.
So. The invisible enemy, whom they could not see, you know, and... Right. They could only, you read, you know, write about this invisible enemy and how they are four and how they were able to overcome. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Yeah. Okay. Enjoy. That's yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.